Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week we are broadcasting to you in vintage black and white to properly discuss François Ozon's new film set in Germany and France just after the end of World War I, France. And joining me in the bunker to bring this film into vivid colour are Freddie Chotel and Danny Verrettanidi. Hello guys.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Yeah, not bad.
Yeah, very good, very good.
Excellent. So this is Ozon's probably, I don't know, 20th film in 20 years. He just keeps cranking them out. He took an extended 2-year break for this one after his last, which I think we can probably forgive him that. I think Ben Wheatley did that for the first time this year as well. Ozon's film follows Anna. This is... played by Paula Beer, a German woman who's grieving the death of her fiancé after he's been killed in World War One, and she lives with her fiancé's parents, and one day a mysterious Frenchman named Adrian, who knew her fiancé, comes to visit. Mm. What do we make of this one?
It's very thrilling. Thrilling? Yeah.
Thrilling?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And mysterious.
Yeah, I think we always tend to look at the marketing and how things are being sold as ways to describe it as, and there's been lots of sumptuous and romantics and sweeping, and I don't think that's maybe right, because you're right, it is thrilling at points, but in ways that we're not expecting it to be. Structurally, it is quite different as to where plot points occur, as to where we might normally expect them to occur as well.
Yeah, for sure.
And although it is set around the war, it's very much not a war film either.
No, it's about lies and grief and people.
Mm. Yeah. I think it's a film that, has been said a couple of minutes ago, that a lot of labels have been attached to it, like sweeping and majestic. Some of that publicity, I think, is a bit unfair, really, on watching the film. I think it's quite a quiet... you know, quite carefully studied piece. I think it's not your traditional war film. I think it's definitely maybe lightly coming at it from a sort of pacifist point of view. Mm. And I think, yeah, it's a really sweet, lovingly made film, really.
Yeah, and I'm not against the way it's being sold at all, because that only that will encourage people to watch it. And like, I'm all for that, because this is something different. It's from a director who has taken a different direction, and I think that needs to be rewarded, because Ozon has been doing a lot of different stuff. I think a favourite of his recent work for me is In the House, which is almost a literary English student Inception trance Desperate Housewives story, which, and so this feels wildly different to that, and his most recent film, The New Girlfriend, as well. It couldn't be more different to that as well.
Yeah, for sure. I've seen The New Girlfriend. I really like that one, but it is really different. Like, I wouldn't say it's the same director, but that's quite good, because I think a lot of times when with like directors that have a lot of films, it's like the auteur kind of label that's stuck with them, and then they kind of, it's hard when they break out.
Yeah.
But I think he did it really well in this one.
Yeah. So to get us started to talk about France, it is no coincidence that France and France are homophones, and we may well get into that later. Yes, France and the country of France. And so for this week's podcast pitch, I was hoping you guys could pitch me a film with a homophonic title to another film that already exists. Freddie, would you like to start us off?
Yeah, I've got a few. So I would pitch the King's Speech, but it's not a film about George VI. But it is, but it's about his favourite type of fruit. Pirates of the Caribbean, that is not a swashbuckling adventure movie. That's a really boring tax exemption movie about pastry filled products in the Caribbean.
That's good.
Thank you.
That sounds like it would be the subtitle to a Dispatches.
Dispatches, indeed. Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah.
And probably a final one, The Horse Whisperer, which is not a film starring Scarlett Johansson. That's set place in a library, probably starring someone like Sylvester Stallone, getting very angry with people with late fees and checking out books.
Oh, and has he got a cold? So
yeah,
he's quite hoarse.
The Horse Whisperer.
That's good. Okay. That's very good. I like The Horse Whisperer. Yeah. Danny?
I only have one. taking Ken Loach's Sweet 16 and changing Sweet to Sweet the Hotel Suite. And mine is set in the 70s, and it's about a couple that won in the radio a room for the night in a hotel, Sweet 16.
Sweet, okay.
And it's basically, they're going, crazy things happen. They're stuck in the room, and it's kind of, I was picturing it like Beetlejuice.
Okay, nice.
So that sort of vibe.
Like 1408 Stephen King kind of mystery hotel room horror kind of situation.
Yeah.
All right.
But funny horror.
Funny horror. Mm. Well, I also went down the horror route, and I know what you guys are thinking. There's not enough PG horror films out there. And so I'm going to fill the gap in that void, because there are a lot of kids out there who want to see horror films and they're sneaking in to them, and like, why don't we make one that they can watch?
Mm.
And so there are two men and they're trapped in a room. They wake up there and they can't escape, and then a message on a little clown cycles into the room.
Oh god, that's my worst nightmare.
And says that they don't have to kill each other or maim each other. They just have to keep giving each other dead legs. Just punching each other in the leg. Nothing too bad, just until they're a bit sore.
Okay, got it.
I like it very much, yeah.
So that's a franchise right there.
Mm. Yeah, Saw 2, Saw 3.
A bit sore.
A bit sore. More sore.
Yeah. Just dead legs, dead arms, noogies. Just like headlocks. There's a whole franchise there of different ways to make people sore.
Mm.
And it's one for the kids, isn't it?
Yeah. One for the kids.
Points there, I don't know. I think I like the King's Peach, but I think The Horse Whisperer might have to be my favourite there. Danny?
Yeah, I'm going to go for Horse Whisperer.
Horse Whisperer, well done. Well done, Freddie. So The Horse Whisperer with Sylvester Stallone going in production this year.
Fantastic.
Right, on to France. So this film is... It's predominantly a black and white film. It's shot on lovely 35mm. Everyone is softly shining. It's a very, very beautiful film. It won the César Award for cinematography, the equivalent of the French Oscars, and that's no coincidence. And I think when we see it on the posters, and so I found the first shot of it to be confusing.
Mm.
Mm.
Because the first shot of France is colour.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I don't. That's not really. It's not a spoiler, because it is the first shot of the film. I think it's just if you've only seen the trailer, it might throw you off there. But it is worth revealing that at the start, because the movement between black and white and colour plays a significant role in how this story is told.
Yeah, absolutely. I also think it's worth pointing out that it's kind of like a retro tinted colour.
Mm.
So it's not. I didn't find it too jarring. And I certainly feel that the colouring of certain scenes and sequences usually tied into time and place, or different sort of spatial and temporal sequences that are happening in the film as well. So I think the film is sort of, in terms of its structure that we were talking about, that it's effectively split into, well, nominally split into two parts. Mm-hmm. There are kind of like undercurrents, and they're really undercurrents of time and memory. And I think that's what the function of, certainly I took from watching France, that the colouring of certain sequences seemed to indicate moments that might not be happening, or maybe never really happened. They are just sort of refractions or compositions in people's characters that you're seeing on screen, memories of people that are gone, or, you know, past times, past events.
Okay, because I didn't necessarily get the temporal thing from it, but I got the idea that black and white is effectively a very unsubtle way of portraying the black cloud of grief.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the moments that the film turns into colour is the moments where people literally are brought back to life, and they show they're able to escape their grief for a little moment, whether that is through memory of the deceased or escape from the grief through someone else or some event. We're introduced through the eyes of Anna, and this is a different way of approaching the story as it has been told before. Is that right?
It's certainly a different way. It's a departure from the original play it was based.
Yeah, because people may not, listening may not know that this is not an original story.
No, this is based on a play translated and sort of adapted into English that was then made into a film by Ernst Lubitsch called Broken Lullaby, which is very close, I believe, to the play itself, the actual original source material. And I was on, in talking about making of this film, had been pitched this idea about adapting this play that I was very fond of, actually. And then was initially struck with kind of despair and depression when he'd found out that Lubitsch had beaten him to the punch.
Mm.
But I think in some respects it handed him a kind of a unique challenge in that, how do you take on, and not really an adaptation, but an adaptation of an adaptation, and there you get this sort of response, which is why, or what he has called, it's a response to Lubitsch rather than, or Lubitsch's realization of the source material, and I think that's why it is split into two parts, without giving too much away.
Yeah, and that second part is the newest part of it. This is where he's really expanded on the play and Lubitsch's film.
Yeah, that's where he's tacked. That's his chance to really bring a lot of new information and new material to a play that's been extant now for about 60, 70 years, I think.
That's really interesting. I would like to see Broken Lullaby.
Yeah, Broken Lullaby is very much, from my understanding, because unfortunately I haven't seen it yet, but my understanding is that it pretty closely matches this film, almost for about an hour. You know, it's really sort of, it's almost 2 hours France, and I think the first hour is very, very close to Lubitsch's. And then the second half, the refocusing around Anna, Paula Beer's character, is definitely Ozon's departure and response to Lubitsch and the play itself.
Yeah. And the showing or telling the story through Anna is a new direction as well, because giving her so much more time and seeing the story and the events unfolding through her is different to those as well, as I understand it anyway.
Yeah, no, certainly. I think it allows a different perspective. If you're talking about the colour scheme, it's certainly grief that you have. It really involves, it's multi-levels of grief, multi-layers of grief. You have Anna and the parents grieving. You have the nation of Germany grieving. You have a broken Europe. So Europe itself, you have two international vistas. You have France and Germany, and they're both shot in black and in monochrome black and white. And even when, in the second half, without giving too much away, when Anna goes to France, that's in black and white. And I think the change from colour to black and white definitely indicates a change in mood. 100%. I definitely think there's a whole discussion about happiness. It's interesting that the word that Adrian doesn't know in German is happy, but he does know it. Obviously, he knows it in French. But there's an early scene where he stumbles on the word happiness, and he has to ask what is happy. So I think definitely there are little nods in the script itself to what those colour sequences are. But I think there's a huge elephant in the room that the title is France, and yet you don't see France. Effectively, he is not there. He's not present at all. So it's about people being wrapped around that, and particularly, obviously, his significant other, who is Anna. So I think that's why the second half is really, really about Anna. Follows Anna.
And so let's bring in. We mentioned Adrian there. Adrian is the instigator of the story here, and so we meet a Frenchman who comes to this small German town to place flowers on the grave of France, so Anna's fiance and the son of the people that Anna is living with as well. And so Danny mentioned at the beginning that this is a thriller in parts, and that's very true in the first half of the film. Because of spoilers, we won't go into too much about what occurs there, but there is this mystery about who Adrian is and what role he has to play in the relationship with France and Anna too. And I think it does play on being the mystery of it is what lures you in, but it uses this foreigner in a foreign land just after the war, just after conflict, to raise some delicate issues that Ozon himself said in the interview that we will play in a bit, he wasn't aware it would become so politically relevant now.
It is quite interesting, because I think, like, when you meet him, he introduces himself as a friend of Anna's fiancé who passed away. But you can tell that's not the case. Like, there's something else going on, and I think that's what draws you into the story, because you try to find out why is he there, why is he visiting them, his grave and everything. And then that lures you in. And then the revelation comes a lot quicker than you would expect.
Yeah.
Because I thought that would be the main narrative arc throughout the whole thing, but it wasn't. And that was a good surprise to me.
Yeah, and that was one of the challenges of the script that Ozon goes into. So let's have a listen to it now. Freddie, you went along to speak to him?
Yeah, it was a lovely chat. Very engaging, very willing to talk about his film. And I think it was... intrigued by the reaction his film was getting, and how a lot of people have been reading lots of sort of political parallels into it. I talked to him about France.
Yeah. And just as a note, there is a translator in the room who there just is. Clears up a few of the questions. So if you're wondering what that voice is. So here we are. This is Freddie and François Ozon.
And I'm delighted to be talking to François Ozon about his new film, France, which will be showing in Curzon Cinemas from the 12th of May.
Hello.
And I really, really love the film. It's a beautiful film. Lots of moments of stillness, interspersed moments of colour and movement and action. And I wanted to ask you about your initial discovery that Ernst Lubitsch had already beat you to the punch, effectively, and that you had to recover from a kind of moment of, I think you said, depression and despair.
Yes.
And then you turned that actually around. Did that initial discovery bring to you a certain freedom, actually, with your adaptation?
Actually, my discovery was first the play. A French play written just after the First World War, and it was a very famous play at this time, totally forgotten today, and it's a friend of mine who told me it's an interesting story, you should read it. So I read the play, I really loved it, and I decided to make an adaptation. But then, doing the adaptation, I realized another director made it already, and it was Lubitsch. So I was a little bit depressed, because how to make a film after Lubitsch, who is one of my favorite director. So I decided to look for the film, which is not very famous, because it was a big flop in the 30s, and I watched it, I really enjoyed it, but I realized
I wanted to make a different film, because the film of Lubitsch was made from the point of view of the French character, and my idea was to tell the story from the point of view of the loser of the war, and especially from the point of view of the young German girl. And the second different thing was the fact Lubitsch made the film in the 30s without knowing that the Second World War would happen. So I knew my perspective would be totally different, and it was impossible to have the same happy ending than in the film of Lubitsch. So I changed really the adaptation. I have a second part in the film which didn't exist in his film and in the play. And it's like an answer to Lubitsch movie, you know.
Yeah, you've described it as a response to the Lubitsch film.
Yes.
And covering on that sort of freedom that that response gives you. I was wondering about the real strong theme that I picked up watching the film, that freedom is often paired with deception. And in this film, there are moments where people deliberately mislead people or might misrepresent certain truths in a way of gaining personal liberty and also providing sort of...
and also providing
freedom for other people. So I'm talking about the Hofmeister as an example.
Okay, so the idea of deception and lies giving that.
Giving some sort of sense of release, some sort of freedom.
Donc le mensonge,
maybe catharsis, actually.
Catharsis, mais que donne l'impression de donner pas seulement une liberté, aussi une opportunité de faire son deuil, de changer, de.
De quoi, le mensonge?
D'avancer. Oui, le mensonge.
It was important for me to tell a story about lies in a certain context. Of course, I didn't want to make a glorification of lies, but I wanted to show that lies can sometimes help you to survive. And I wanted to show this paradox and to give the opportunity to the audience to ask themselves what would have done in the same case, you know, because it's a moral case. What should do Anna in the same context, or what should you do at the place of Adrien? So I wanted to ask all these questions. I don't have the answers, but I wanted to show the ambiguity and the complexity of this situation, especially in a period like the war, which is a period of mourning, of grief. And all these questions were very strong for me, so I wanted, yes, to work on that.
Fantastic. You just mentioned the war, and the film opens in 1919, and it's the immediate aftermath of this cataclysmically awful event. And you have these people using deception to try and find solace or some sort of peace, inner peace. You're shown communities in France and Germany both allying themselves with a sort of sense of... There are two scenes in two bars. I won't go into too much detail for those people who haven't seen it. But where a song is completed and they could be perceived as patriotic and nationalistic or bearing those sort of sentiments. Was that deliberate on your behalf, and was it enforced by anything that's going on in today's current political climate?
I didn't know my film will become so political, because my idea was first to make a film about secrets and lies, but when I decided to develop the historical context, I had, of course, to speak about nationalism, especially in Germany, because we know after the Treaty of Versailles and the humiliation of losing the war, we know that in Germany the roots of Nazism are there, and the rise of nationalism will happen because of losing the war. So it was important to show this context, but at the same time I wanted to show that the French nationalism was the same. You know, at the end, nationalism from France or from Germany, it's the same thing. You know, it's the same stupid thing. So I wanted to show the danger, of course, of nationalism. That's why it was important, especially in the second part of the film, to hear the song of the national song, French song, La Marseillaise, with the ears of a German character, you know, because in France we are so used to hearing this song for a match of football or anything. I wanted to hear the songs in the context of war, you know, to hear the lyrics, because the lyrics are very violent, but we are so used to hearing the lyrics were forgotten, but it can be very shocking, you know. So I wanted to have this scene in mirror with the German one in the Gustav.
Fantastic. Talking about music as well, and how it's another sort of central theme that keeps recurring in this film of yours. And I would say that it's interesting that a lot of music is incomplete, or is people are unable to finish it. And there's a line in one of Franz's letters saying that the noise is terrible here. Mm-hmm. And this idea that war has made peacetime or post a conflict time mm-hmm. impossible to have sort of song and dance. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if that was reflected in your choice of going, shooting it in a sort of monochrome, and that when memory is returned to certain characters, it's back into colour and there's an increased level of song, dance and movement.
It was not my option, but if you feel it, it's good. You know? For me, I wanted, of course, to use music to express the feelings of the characters. And Adrien and Franz are musicians. Mm. So it's a film about music, of course. And one scene was very important. It's when the German father gives the violin to Adrien. Mm. And he says, it's like the art of my son. So there is a kind of transmission with the music. And it's really part of the story. But I wanted to say in a certain way, there is no message, there is no political message, but I wanted to show that culture in general can help different countries to be closed and different people. And you see that all the relationship between Adrien and Anna, they share culture, you know, together. He's able to, and language, you know, he's able to speak German, she's able to speak French, she knows French literature, he knows German literature, the music is important, so the fact to know the culture of other country helps you to not to make war. Maybe it's a very simple message, but I think culture can help us to understand better the foreigners.
Yeah. So touching on sort of cultural communication and a sort of shared cultural transmission, which you've just talked about.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could view French language, particularly in the first half of the film, as a kind of secret language that is used by Anna
and
Franz.
Yes.
And that is that's effectively what brings Adrien mm-hmm. into that relationship. So they all share a shared secret language that nobody else seems to be able to speak mm-hmm. in Germany. And I was wondering if the sort of memories that he takes in from that letter that he reads out and is able to recite from memory, do we see France, or are we seeing a kind of composite creation of France through other people's memory?
That's the big question.
Sorry.
That's the big question, of course, of the film. I think France is... there are different France in the film. There is the France of Adrien. There is the France of Anna, and there is the France of the parents. And each one has his idea of France. And actually, we don't know exactly who was France. That's why the scene in Paris when she goes in the hotel is so important, because suddenly she realized that maybe what France said was not the truth. Mm. And I wanted to show that we have an image of someone we love, and it's a kind of idealization very often. And that's why the title of the film is France, because everybody has his own vision and opinion about the character. Mm. But at the end, we'll never know who he was exactly.
Yeah. And talking about these cultural ideals, creating idealistic or ideal people, you choose sort of art, poetry and music as being key sort of totems or touchstones to bring France back to life. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you are suggesting that it's really culture and art that creates an individual's persona or personality in that film. Because it seems to be, for Anna and Adrien, they seem to be able to form this reimagining of France.
Je n'ai pas bien compris.
Que ce serait la culture et l'art qui, en fait, créent la personne, en font ce que la personne est.
I'm not sure it was not what I wanted to tell. For me, it was important to show that art helped these young people to survive. That's the meaning of the last scene when she's in front of the painting, Le Suicidé, which is like a metaphor of all the story. She's able to say something very paradoxal. It gives me l'envie de vivre.
Makes me want to live.
Mm. It makes me want to live in front of someone who is dead. And I think it's the paradox, but it's what art is done for, you know. She has a kind of distance. She's like watching a film, you know. You go to cinema to see murders, to see terrible things, but you don't want to commit suicide after.
Mm.
So I think the fact to have this distance, she has understood something about herself, and she's able to turn the page, and she keep a kind of distance with all that story, and that's what I wanted to show at the end.
Fantastic. And in terms of Anna, you have refocused your retelling of this play and this
yes.
film around Anna.
Yes.
What do you think that brings to the film?
I think it it gives you the opportunity to share our emotions, because we discover with her the secret of Adrien in the play and in the film of Lubitsch. You knew from the first minutes what was his secret, and I had the feeling to discover that in the middle of the film was stronger, because it changed totally the perspective of the film. And some people think they had a certain idea of the relationship between Adrien and Franz, and suddenly things are changing, and you have another vision, and suddenly the films become something else. And I think it's always interesting to change the vision of the audience and the feelings and the sensations, you know. At the same time, I knew it was dangerous, because it's challenging. Usually you have a twist at the end of the film, not in the middle of the film.
Mm.
So I didn't know if it will work or not. And but for me, it was the big challenge of the film, to tell the story in this way.
One last question.
Yes.
You talked about your decision of filming in black and white, bringing a sort of increased sense of realism to mm-hmm. that subject matter, because it suits the sort of First World War, everything black and white, our kind of collective memory, cultural
mm-hmm.
memory of images from that time in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a conscious decision to maybe move towards a kind of an aesthetic that's slightly more traditional filmically. I wanted to...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'll ask you a question about the rise of online streaming of film, and do you think that will affect future decisions for you when you're making your films?
The fact to shoot in black and white was a late decision, because it was 2 weeks before the shooting. It was a way, as you said, to be more realistic, because all our memories of this time are in black and white. And I knew it was quite complex to make the film in black and white, especially today, because the French cinema is financed by television, and you know, when you make a film in black and white, it won't be on prime time.
Mm.
So my producers were quite upset and nervous about this choice, but they understood that artistically it was important for the film, and it was stronger and more realistic to shoot it in black and white. So they accepted that. And the fact the film was already in German, it
mm.
was already something difficult to accept and to assume. But they trust me artistically, and at the end the film was successful in France and Germany. So I'm very happy to have made this choice. But and the other question was about the streaming. I know the way of watching movies is changing. You know, people are going to see movies on telephone or on computer. But what can you do against that? It's not because they do that you have to shoot all your film in close-up, you know, it will be stupid. So for me, it doesn't change anything. I try to be the film the better as I can, and the mise-en-scène try to follow the story, and that's it.
Thank you very much.
There we are. So Francois Ozon talking to Freddie, and he was in good form.
He was in very good form. And I think before we broke for the interview, we were talking about that sort of the mystery around Adrian, the mystery of the film, and how he's also an outsider, I think is interesting. And that this, certainly in the, when I was talking to him, he was, I think he was surprised how much people were reading into the sort of politicization of a couple of scenes, because there are a couple of scenes that mirror one another. And they're often paired with music. I was wondering what people thought about the use of music in this film, particularly the two songs that are completed.
So this would be, there's what, the Marseillaise,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what's the other one? Thing?
The Watch on the Rhine, which is a German patriotic anthem.
I think as an Englishman reading the subtitles as well, I think I had a different experience than if it was in the native language, because we are reading the words. Obviously, I'd never fully appreciated the lyrics in these and the violence in them. And that's what really struck me. And how, when, like, even the Champions League football this week, and if someone's singing a national anthem, and you're in the melody and the rhythm, and you're not paying attention to what it actually means, and actually reading the words of La Marseillaise, and particularly with them being in Anna being in the situation that she's in, just having to observe that, and the guilt and grief that she's holding on to, and having to and as she understands French as a German person, it must just be so horrible to understand that and have it almost feel like it's being directed at you.
Yeah, I think it was purposefully done, because I remember reading an interview and he was saying that he wanted for the song to be heard through German girl's ears, so then the lyrics come, obviously with the subtitles, just makes you realise the meaning of them a lot more clear.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's interesting that there's sort of three primary characters, really. It could be argued to be Adrian, Anna and Franz, and they're all multilinguists, at least they're bilinguists, so they all have this exchange of cultural transmission through language. So they are on a kind of a pedestal in that they can understand the maybe the sort of violence of those lyrics from an outsider's perspective and an insider's perspective. And in both scenes, you have groups of people who seem to be only, you know, they're native speakers. So the impact of the violence of the language, or the sort of heart pounding, heart thumping, chest beating patriotism of the German song, might not will definitely register in a different way. And I think that in terms of the film, in terms of dialogue, you have a dialogue that those three share, and they can be sort of mutual, have a mutual understanding through language. But then you get this, these two scenes that definitely set them apart, and you see certainly a Europe in the aftermath of a terrible event, trying to make sense of what's happened. And these three are able to act as sort of go-betweens, and they're useful characters to follow as the viewer, because I think he shows Anna's face, and he shows Adrian's face in extreme close up as they're listening to the songs, and they are being pointed out as outsiders, but yet they're more willing probably to come to some sort of mutual understanding after such a terrible event. And they're actually bringing people closer together, arguably.
It's a funny one, because I know Ozon himself is clearly doesn't want us to think of this in context now. He wants to think of it almost like a period film, and that we view it as existing for its own time rather than now. But the way that I think post-conflict breeds a communal nationalism, it just feels
very real.
Yeah, it feels so potent. And the fact that there are a group of people that are happy to commune between countries and communicate with each other and move between countries, and that for that union they are being segregated.
Yeah. And it's not surprising that those people are young people. Yeah. As well.
Yeah, you have one person, Mr. Hofmeister, who is the older person in the small German town of Anna in France, and him and his wife appear to be the only people, because they meet someone and talk to them and understand them, that they can actually see how war has affected the other side of the border. And there is a really great speech by Mr. Hofmeister at what I imagine is some kind of Rotary club. Yeah. Or equivalent within the Germantown, where he talks about the fathers sending off the sons to war, and that it's just as much on their shoulders as it is on the enemy's shoulders what's happened, and it just doesn't seem to get through, and it seems so obvious as well.
Yeah.
That the enemy is maybe not the enemy. The enemy has just been told what to do, and they've just been told the same thing you have.
Hmm.
Absolutely. I think there's also in that sort of like elders meeting, which is in a very picturesque German, I think it's Quedlingburg is the name of the village, and it looks, on the surface at least, like a sort of a painting of a village that you'd seen, like a chocolate box. It's absolutely pristine.
The whole film, every frame of it looks like old photograph.
Mm.
It's really nicely shot.
Yeah.
And gives that time and space that it's being, the story is being built.
Yeah, there's a really lovely dance that they talk, that is a plot point through the first half of the film, that Anna has. There's a dance going on in the town. Anna has no one to go with because she would be going with France, and so she declines the offer of Mr. Kreutz, and then Adrian comes to town and they become friends and they eventually go to the dance. And I think when we think of these kind of dance events that we see in film, like, I don't know, I might think of the wedding in Harry Potter or something, or a carnival, or and what really affects me on this is just how empty it actually looked. And how it must have felt trying to throw a party after the war. And that eventually people do enjoy it, but it just feels a bit sparse. And I don't know, that image of the party kind of thrown together because people need something really struck me there.
Yeah, I think lack of people, indicative of what's just happened. I think Adrian comes in, and he's also coming in from the position of being the victor. You know, he's actually one of he's the member of the people that have won and have insisted on very hard punitive measures against Germany. So it's bitter resentment, and paired with the fact that he's now dancing with probably one of the only eligible widowers, effectively, or not quite widowers, but somebody who's lost who's lost France. After she spurned Mr. Kreutz's advances, I think is viewed as a deep insult.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, he is the young man that's come to town, and he's rubbing his youth and survival in the face of the older men, the fathers, and the women who have no other young men in the village to dance with. And you understand, because he's very hesitant to engage with that. And he's very aware, and he says that he would be a pacifist as well, and he doesn't want to be hated, and he tries so hard to not be that person, but a lot of the men's minds there aren't going to be changed, and that's unfortunately something that will not happen. There might be one or two, like the Hofmeisters, but that lingering hate, even though he has nothing to do with it, just keeps going. So that's really Adrian and Anna, that he gives her a bit of friendship and that she hasn't really had since France, have, and a bit of companionship. But Adrian's arrival in the town has a huge effect on the Hofmeisters, France's parents.
Yeah. I think when he comes, well, obviously, father, when as soon as he hears he's French, he's very angry and hesitant and doesn't want to like treat him because he's a doctor. But then he opens up because when he finds out that he used to be friends with Franz. And I think Adrian kind of fills in the gap in for Franz. So he becomes like the adopted son, kind of, because of that friendship that he had. And I think that's how he is for Anna as well.
Yeah, he tells us stories of how they met in Paris and they went to the Louvre and particular paintings that Franz enjoyed and what they did together. And he picks up Franz's old violin and plays for them. And they and there is, I think, there is a line where it's, she says it's like having him back for the day.
Yeah.
Even though it's a different man, he looks completely different. Through the stories of their son, they're able to bring him back. And that those are the moments where we come back into colour for a bit, where we give them, they give Franz back to them.
Yeah, I think Adrian could be read as a cipher/proxy for Franz. He certainly adopts or seems to slowly adopt the position of Franz. He seems to know an awful lot about Franz and about sort of Franz's social mores and behaviours and cultural interests. Talks about Franz's love of Verlaine, love of the Louvre. They are both violinists as well. Adrian is more skilled, was at the conservatory in Paris. Franz is more of a sort of dilettante. He's you know, he can play for the family and he could probably play at family events and maybe that sort of town dance, but in no way could he be a sort of professional violinist. And it's this sort of shared level of culture and a love of art and those particular arts that I think brings Adrian to the bosom of the family and particularly triggers an interesting relationship, I would say, between Adrian and Anna.
Yeah, because I think it's, there's definitely a romance hinted at between Franz and Adrian, which is, it's not hidden.
No.
I think we're definitely led down that path. And that kind of leads us to a confusing route to the relationship between Anna and Adrian and how that their relationship will develop because of the way that Adrian talks of Franz is so loving that I think we're given given a map to where this may go.
Yeah.
But where does it go? You must watch Franz to find out. And so do go and check that out in Curzon Cinemas and on Curzon Home Cinema if you haven't already. If you have seen it and would like to stick around for our spoiler chat, we'll be doing that just now, as well as at the end of the show, our Curzon Home Cinema recommendations. So if you haven't watched Franz, go and watch it. It's your spoiler warning. And we will be going into second half, third act revelations and all that jazz now. So, the twist. Were we expecting the twist?
No, because as you said before, I thought it was going to go with Adrian being in a relationship with Franz.
Yeah.
Which it didn't. And that surprised me because I thought I was waiting for the other thing to happen. And also it happened quite quick. So the twist is that Adrian killed Franz in the war. And we find out halfway through. And Anna does not react very well at first.
Well, I mean, part of the twist is where it happens in the story.
Yeah.
We're so used for having, I know, two-thirds, three-quarters, and then we get our twist, and then we get our finale. And structurally, this almost bang on halfway, this is where it happens. And that's what threw me out, because I knew how long the film was, and so that happening there really threw me. I thought it was really clever. I did not see it coming. I thought it, what they were going down the gay relationship route between Adrian and Franz, and I thought, I figured this out, it's too obvious. They're giving us way too much on it. And for the time period, that will be a really interesting narrative to take. And so him just shooting him point blank was very unexpected.
Yeah, I think it's interesting as well that it comes halfway through in that in Broken Lullaby, you're aware of what has happened from the very beginning. And one of the main changes that Ozon has made to this material is that he moves it halfway through, which is interesting in itself, but he added an extra layer of suspense, because I think, as you both said, that you are left questioning what's exactly happened. The way that Adrian almost ritualistically is visiting the grave, it seems, and slightly secretively, I would say, is suggestive that there may be a sort of romantic, possibly a romantic attachment to it. Well, that seems a more likely sort of scenario than the one that's eventually revealed. And then is revealed, as you said, surprisingly, pretty much at the midpoint of the film, which leaves another hour, maybe another 45 minutes.
Yeah, I was like, what's going to happen now?
Yeah. Well, I thought after that reveal, we'll follow mostly Anna and Adrian, and she then has to deal with telling the parents or not. And I ultimately thought the end of the film would be her leaving him, but leaving the parents under the belief that Adrian is who they expect him to be. And I thought that would be the end of the film. But thankfully, again, really changing my expectations throughout, that then is the next scene, that Anna decides to let them live with the belief that Adrian is who they want him to be. And I think that is running throughout the film, and it's the use of lies and how ultimately they can be good for the right reasons, but it depends, I suppose, the ethics of lying, isn't it, around death, which is such a humongous topic.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that she was lying because they were happy finally. They finally got, like, someone that they can move on from the tragedy of losing their son. So she probably wanted to, like, preserve that and not ruin their fantasy. But then she ends up lying even more towards the end of the film about her being, well, her being in France and everything. Mm-hmm. And it just felt a bit unnecessary to me.
Right.
Well, but that I understand, like, her character motivation, I guess.
Yeah. I think it's that keeping lying to keep people feeling okay.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Anna, selfishly, Adrian gives that burden to Anna rather than holding it for himself. We think in the moment that he tells her, he is unburdening himself, but all he's doing is transferring it to her.
Yeah.
And she now has to be the guardian of the Hofmeisters, as well as living with the knowledge she now has too.
Yeah, I think he even describes that as like it was my attempt to unburden. I came to you because I needed to unburden myself. And I do think that giving that truth finally to Anna, or firstly to Anna, that rids him of that guilt. And she has to make a decision what to tell the Hofmeisters. And she does effectively lie. Mm-hmm. But I think if she wasn't to lie, they would lose France for a second time.
Yeah. Mm.
And I think that would be terminally damaging to the Hofmeisters, particularly their position in the community, the way they've welcomed Adrian with open arms, the way they've been open to gossip and a judgment, and have actually managed to convince some of the community members, maybe, that the more progressive and open attitude and a cultural exchange is the way to go.
Yeah, to go back to them and then say, oh, that Frenchman
was everything you feared, effectively.
Yeah.
I think it would be terrible.
Mm.
Yeah.
But also he discusses, like, the fact that he did kill him. What happened because of the war, and how he was the whole sequence of him come to France and actually pulling the trigger. It was just, I think it was a nice thing of showing how it was because he was the enemy as he was presented in the war, you know what I mean? It could have been someone else. And I think that's a big part of the film as well.
Yeah, and it's not a coincidence that France is called France.
Yeah.
Because it is this very same story could be occurring in any number of little German villages mm-hmm. and little French villages after that war and after the Second War. And yeah, I think it's in the later, in the second half of the film, that we introduce to Fanny, who is Adrian's fiancée, and she lost her brother in the war, called Francois.
Yeah.
Again, not a coincidence there. So, what do we make of Fanny in that introduction? That when we get shown that Adrian has crafted a life whilst trying to deal with his grief.
Well, I thought it was interesting because Adrian seems like a completely different person in the second half of the film when he's actually in his own place with his family, with his surroundings that he grew up with. And there, you lose that mystery at the beginning where he looked like that charming, mysterious Frenchman. He's not that anymore. He's just a man that has a fiance,
yeah,
lives with his mom.
He's far less cool.
Yeah,
actually.
Yeah,
because he's not the stranger in town. And his although he is post-war and he's looking for help and comfort and structure and living with his parents, that's fine. It's still a unconscious thing for us to think, oh, he's gone to live with his mum. It's not as cool and he's not as interesting. And I think we do see a different side of him. And I'm not sure how much the relationship of Fanny really is. I don't think it is what he wants. But
no.
I think he has just been torn apart so much that it's easier for him to have something easy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I also think maybe it's easier for him to remain a habitual liar. Just to survive. I think he's so shattered. There's an indication that he's spent some time in a sanatorium possibly as well.
Yeah,
So I think that ability maybe to split himself, especially if we go back to the idea that maybe there was something a little bit more to his and France's or not Francois actually. There's an indication, there's a line like, I particularly like Fanny's brother. Maybe it's just a way of him surviving at this point and feeling some degree of comfort at that point, you know, and not feeling guilty.
I think that's, you feel like everyone in this film is just surviving. Like everyone is broken and everyone is just trying their best to stay glued together.
Yeah. And then there's that painting when that Adrian mentioned at the beginning of
Le Suicide.
Yeah. Which comes up quite a lot. And Anna goes to the Louvre to see it as well. And she finds an attachment to it as well. And I thought that was quite interesting because obviously it portrays death. But she was saying that by looking at it, she kind of had the courage to find, to be alive, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, it's a shame we don't have our Helen here, our resident history of artist, to to delve into that painting, because it is really interesting. And the final shot of the film is seeing it in colour, which I think is key to understanding that painting as well, because I think whenever we see a painting in the film, you've got to look it up afterwards and read more on it. And so I had a look at this Manet painting, and this is even on the Manet website, so manet.com. I've got this quote. They said, taking their cue from Manet's early biographer Adolphe Tabarant, who flippantly characterised Le Suicide merely an incident of the palette, scholars have now dismissed the painting as an emotionally detached study of light and colour, which I thought was really interesting. That this is not regarded in Manet's work, and because it has a lack of narrative, it has a lack of connection to anything before or after it. It exists unto itself, and particularly that line about light and colour. I suddenly thought, I wonder at what point this painting for Ozon became key in telling this story. Because when you see the painting in colour, the flash of red becomes so significant in it. And we're shown the painting twice in black and white in the film, and we don't see that as well, because it's someone that's shot themselves whilst lying on their bed, and it just looks like bed covers. You don't see much to it. And then in that final shot, you'd see the blood. And so her saying that it gives her life feels all that more poignant.
Yeah, for sure.
I think the final revelation is key as well, because I think the picture is at first described to us, and it's described as a Francis' favourite picture of a boy with his head thrown back.
Yeah.
But he doesn't explicitly state that it's a figure who's dead. So I think
until we see it with Anna. Yeah,
absolutely. So I think the Hofmeisters are left with this idea of that it's maybe just, you know, a lovely scene. Head thrown back usually means somebody laughing. And then when it's finally revealed to be somebody who's taken their own life, and then it provides sort of succour to Anna to then go on and live. It's a release. And I think that the Manet painting is a break from tradition, certainly art history tradition, and those ideas of those sort of grand scenes, those grand tableaux, which he was kicking against. And it was just a more real instance. It was a scene from everyday life, or a life possibly led.
Yeah. I wonder if it's a way of, like, for her, like, because in the film, that it goes into colour for that last scene. And I wonder if, like, looking at that painting, for her, it's almost looking at the death of France. And by seeing it in colour and remembering him in colour and remembering as he was, rather than the death of him, that's what she's ultimately trying to gain from that. And on that jolly note, we should probably wrap up. So that's Francois Ozon's France, which is out this week. It's out in cinemas, and it's out on Curzon Home Cinema as well. So if you can't make it to a big screen, you can check it out on a small one at home. And whilst we're here, we've got some other recommendations for Curzon Home Cinema, as there is a Colourful Lives in Monochrome collection that's live on there just now, with a wonderful selection of other modern black and white films. So we've got the likes of The White Ribbon.
Yeah, a fantastic Haneke film. It's about, again, quite a remote German village, and it's really a study of the banality and extreme cruelty of everyday life, and the ordinariness of it, and how that, taken to its logical extension, can be extraordinarily cruel. And it's worth watching.
You mentioned in the interview there that there are lots of moments in stillness in France, and it almost feels like France is the calm after the storm of World War One, and White Ribbon has those same moments.
The horrible brother.
Of that lingering fate that is oncoming as well. Also in the collection is Frances Ha.
That's with Greta Gerwig. It's by Noam Bombage. It's a lot more fun than the ones we've been talking about.
If you're going to triple bill it, put Frances Ha at the end.
Definitely. And it's about a girl in New York and how she is going about with her life. It's really good.
Yeah, or not going. If you're below 30 listening to this and struggling with everything and what to do and all those things, just watch this and it will assure you that it's fine. Also out on there this week is La La Land, so if you didn't get the chance to watch did it win Best Picture again? I don't remember. so if you do want to go and watch that, that's on Home Cinema this week as well, so do check La La Land out too, if somehow you have missed that. And that's all for this week. So thank you to CSR for letting us use their studio as always. It's goodbye from Freddie.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Danny.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.